Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And that's Ann.
This is Ann.
And this is Peter. That's a surprise.
Yeah.
It's really funny, you know, when some people call us, most people who call on our home line ask for Ann, and then when I answer, they say, "Hello, Ann." I never did quite understand that she had such a deep voice. I thought there was a difference between us that you'd all be able to tell.
Yeah, and I don't have an accent.
No. Anyway, what are we doing?
We're having another go around with chefs, bakers, techniques, products. Up first is probably one of the most exciting entries into the restaurant scene. Vitaly Paley and his wife have a new cookbook out. Their restaurant is in
Portland, Oregon,
we'll talk a little bit about that with the Paleys, and you'll be surprised how they ended up there.
Well, some people, when they say location, 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 they're talking about putting a business someplace. But when I'm talking to Vitaly Paley and Kimberly Paley, I'm talking about where they opened their restaurant in the Pacific Northwest. They have access to absolutely the best of ingredients. I'm reading this cookbook called The Paley's Place Cookbook. You just can't get distracted from the great quality of produce you guys have.
That's exactly one of the reasons why Kimberly and I both moved out here. It's the ingredient was the big draw.
Oh, I mean, there's so much in this book. It's just gorgeous, I might say.
Your
history is interesting. You were born in Russia, Vitaly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Kimberly, you were from the West Coast, were you?
Yes.
Yeah, California. And you met in New York. Kimberly was studying modern dance. That was going to be her career. And, you know, that takes a lot of drive and concentration. And Vitaly was a piano protege studying at Juilliard. Is that not amazing? And you met working in what restaurant?
Well, we were actually met in transition from careers out of dance and out of music at a place called World Yacht Cruises, of all things.
Oh, that's right.
I'm thinking they don't even exist anymore.
I've never heard of them.
On boats that at the time would do a lot of celebrity work, a lot of dining out on the water. I remember when Mayor Koch was in. Anyways, we did a lot of work at the World Yacht Cruises as cruise managers, involved with food and wine and service there. And
so you had already left your careers in dance and piano.
I think this was an in-between kind of stage. Is when you're in between projects, you need something to do, so you end up working in a restaurant, you know, and eventually it just grabs a hold of you. it's one of those industries that I think, you know, it draws people in. It really is able to, you know, you kind of get addicted to it. And eventually you just decide what you want to do for the rest of your life, and it just becomes, you know, your second nature.
And as a dancer, you don't just wake up one day and stop. I mean, I had to continue physically, you know, with class and such. It was really about not auditioning any longer.
Uh-huh. But your first big move, Vitaly, after training at the French Culinary Institute, was you and Kimberly said, well, we're going to find out how it's really done, so you headed off to France?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, the chef from the World Yacht Cruises, his name was Michel Bordeaux at that point, he was a French master chef. He was a great friend of ours, and he was able to connect us with some folks in France, and that allowed us to make a trip out there and spend best part of 1991, I don't remember. We spent a best part of that year in France learning, and it really opened our eyes. It really made us understand, you know, how to cook from the source, how to understand your region, and how to be able to respect your ingredients that come from around you. And also, you know, becomes a part of life for people that are surrounded by food, and it's no longer a job. And so we brought that ethic back with us. Back
in this case was back to New York City and the thriving, bustling dining scene in New York City.
Oh, yeah, back in the...
And you've worked with some really wonderful chefs and restaurateurs.
We were definitely lucky to be able to work with some of the best. I worked with Michael Romano at Union Square Cafe for a few years, and Kimberly worked with David Belay back in the heyday when it was original Duane Street.
Was he temperamental, Kimberly?
Quite so, but quite talented, so you just forget about all that.
Uh-huh, okay.
While you're in the kitchen or in the front of the house, his total artistry and work and ethic was just unsurpassed and reminded me quite of being back in France.
I see.
Left Europe, you know, over a year working in a Michelin-starred restaurants and days a week. You know, we both had a discipline coming from art backgrounds, so that put a spine in us, and certainly living in France put a spine in us, and so we ended up working back in restaurants in New York City after living in Europe with that same sort of demeanor and premise of ethics and work, you know, and hard
and
work.
Discipline. And discipline. That's a thought I hadn't even had about this. You really are disciplined. For me, you were naturally disciplined with what you were doing before.
Absolutely. I think that both supported our endeavor in this industry is just being very true and very disciplined to what we love.
Now, we were talking before we came on the air about some other great friends of yours, David and Karen Waltok, and you must have learned a lot from them, not just about how to do chefing in front of house, but also about how to do it and have your marriage survive.
You know, the when I worked for them, and it was fairly brief period that I worked for them right before we came out to Oregon, I was impressed with the way they were able to keep their composure and run a four star New York Times restaurant and basically just pour out their hearts on a daily basis, and it really translated into a cohesive place. If Kimberly and I didn't have plans to move out to Oregon, I probably would have made it my home for a lot longer than I have. And of course, working with a good friend and a mentor of ours, Roger DeGorn, Master Sommelier, is a wonderful human being who was able to impart so much knowledge onto us, and we're indebted to him and to them for life. I always refer back to, you know, Karen and David when we look at Kimberly's and I adventures in restaurant business, and I just say, look, those two really had something going, and we always look back and say, this is an example we want to follow.
But you struck out. You said New York isn't it. It's got to be somewhere where the ingredient base is more authentically local. How was it that you picked Portland, Oregon?
Well, I have to say that after living in New York for so long, which we loved, after living in France, the source of ingredients became important to us, and our relationships, people who we got products from, were just crucial. We certainly love the farmers markets in New York City as well, and then when we came to Oregon to consider living here, Vitaly and I just fell in love with it. The Willamette Valley, the wine region, truly reminded us of France, and we had a big heart for that experience. And we owned an apartment in the city, and we thought, okay, let's take about a year, and we'll seek out different places to go to in the country. We considered Oregon, and then our apartment sold in 3 days. And we not only did we think we didn't, you know, say enough money to sell it, we said, oh, my goodness, where are we going? And Vitaly said, it's meant to be. That's it. Let's do Oregon. And we literally came out on a one-way ticket with a moving van line with our whole slice of life in this bus with a one-bedroom apartment in New York. And Vitaly tipped the driver and said to drive slow. We're not quite sure where we're going to be in Oregon, but we're going to be out there. And it was a very emotional departure, but you know, we both wanted to leave, and we both wanted to start something new.
You know, Peter has always wanted to live in Portland.
I love Portland.
I think it's
a city with a tremendous amount going for it.
Oh, I like it. It's just that my blood's Mediterranean.
It's really funny. Apropos absolutely nothing. We were talking to our local Pittsburgh City Councilman last night about the city and the mess it's in, and the city that he was saying. Pittsburgh could be Portland, Oregon. I know. I've been there. I know that you can put a city together properly, and they have.
Portland, we
haven't. I said, I totally agree with you. I've been saying that for 25 or 30 years, and no one listens. And is that where you are?
Portland has been on the alternative kind of lifestyle for many years, and I think now it's proving to be true that, you know, it started out as this hippie little town with Birkenstocks, as Kimberly likes to call it, and hairy armpits, and it became the model of green sustainability, you know, and nothing is more than 15 minutes away from any place. There's incredible green centers everywhere. There's one of the biggest parks in the country that boasts 200 miles of walking and hiking trails.
That's a fabulous park with all the roses, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember that.
And then goes into the forest park, and it's just like right there. And the way I like to describe the differences between New York and Portland is, New York to me is like this big city with a small park in the center, and Portland is just the opposite. It's a big park with a
small city.
And it's very apparent. I commute to work on my bicycle pretty much every day.
It doesn't rain too much, though. Huh?
Well, you know, it rains too much, but we're used to the rain. We're not made of sugar. We won't melt, you know, and that's kind of the mentality that most of us have. And for me as a food professional, yeah, it rains 9 months out of the year, but when it stops raining, look what comes out of the ground. Yeah.
Now you know the story of how Portland got its name, right?
Well, maybe you can enlighten me.
There was a man from Portland, Maine, and a man from Boston, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh. Oh, right.
They were both in Portland, Oregon, and they both wanted to name the city after them.
Uh-huh.
So they flipped a coin.
Interesting.
And the man from Portland, Maine won. Otherwise, it would have been called Boston.
Boston, Oregon.
Boston, Oregon. Why not?
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us a little bit about, first of all, the style of your restaurant, and then is this your first cookbook?
Well, in terms of the style of the restaurant, our restaurant is bistro-like, meaning that it's relaxed, comfortable. We pride ourselves on serving interesting food, local farmers, but nothing esoteric. It's Vitali's not about handling and manipulating food much. It's really about the product, its ripeness, and how it falls onto the plate. And being small, we're a 50-seat restaurant and a small bar. The wine list is Oregon, Washington, and French.
Well, you still have a good collection there.
Yeah, and being small and focused allowed me to just keep the wine list in that genre. Not that I don't love Italian and Spanish and Australian and New Zealand. I mean, all the other wines are fantastic.
Oh, right.
But the focus is that, and we've kept it such.
Makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, and then I work the front of the house, and Vitali has his crew in the kitchen.
Yeah, as far as the kitchen is concerned, we're definitely very militant about seasonal ingredients in our kitchen. And literally through the winter months, there'll be nothing green in the kitchen except for some storage Brussels sprouts and onions and rutabaga and all that stuff, and we get real creative with that stuff. There's something about being so militant about seasonality that brings out a creativity in you.
Well, this comes through in this cookbook.
Well, we try to definitely take what we have in the restaurant and really bring it forth to the bigger audience that we're able to appeal to in the cookbook. And the recipes definitely, all of them, I think if not most of them, all of them have appeared on our menu on and off throughout the past 15 years of us being open.
But they're so clear. I could just taste the flavors from them. Asparagus with smoked salmon and dill butter. I mean, what could be more straightforward than that?
The asparagus just came on the scene, and it's promptly on our menu with some smoked salmon butter. It definitely represents a sense of place. You've got the asparagus, you've got the dill, you've got the salmon. To me, it brings back a little bit of my Russian upbringing, and of course, the the salmon is the king out here, so it's definitely there.
You don't have Russian salad on your... I don't understand Russian salad. I mean, it's probably one of the hottest items in tapas bars in Spain, and I don't understand it at all.
It's like Russian dressing, which has no roots in Russia either.
No, it does have roots in Russia, doesn't it?
I don't know.
Well, see, the Russian salad, it's kind of an interesting thing because Russian salad in France called the macédoine de légumes, and you actually learn it as one of the 75 most classic French recipes.
Exactly.
When you're a French culinary institute, that's what I learned. And then I go back to my roots, and salad Olivier, as it was called, was on every holiday table in every Russian home throughout the ages. And so this is the roots of...
And this was the same thing?
Well, all the French aristocrats used to live in Paris anyway.
You think that's true.
You think they lived in Russia in the wintertime? You must be kidding.
So it's basically a Russian salad, but it was made up by a French chef, and it was done in Moscow back in the 1800s, and that's kind of how it all began. So the French and Russian connection has always been very strong. You know, so the Russians will eat their caviar with vodka, and the French will drink champagne with it, but it's still caviar, and it's from Russia.
Yeah, the pages keep accidentally falling open to the Paley's Reuben sandwich because I've been craving. I would say that probably, because I get to eat all the time, as you can well imagine, about the only thing that I really crave is a Reuben sandwich, which I avoid because of the calorie content of it.
Oh, a nice, a big sloppy Reuben sandwich, especially late at night.
Oh, I love it.
Nothing is like it. It's delicious, absolutely delicious. And what's great about our Paley's Place cookbook is that you can, read stories about some things and recipes that as well, get it dirty in the kitchen. We wanted this cookbook to get used in the kitchen, and we like them both.
Well, you have great stories also about people who supply you with things like the Mushroom Man.
Yeah, Lars is a very interesting fella. He's he definitely knows the local areas really well. He'll take you to the Bass Patch to pick up some stinging nettles or fresh morels or when the porcinis come into season. And that's the amazing part about us being right outside your doorstep. You could just walk up the hill and boom, there's just a mushroom patch.
Oh, wow.
Now, are you really disciplined about it? I mean, do you draw a ring around Portland and say, I will not buy anything that comes from outside of this?
I'd say more and more these days I am as close to home as possible. I would say in season about 95% of what we buy comes from around the area of about 150-mile radius.
Do you get local lamb there?
Yes. Yeah, we get lamb. We've got chickens from the Willamette Valley. We've got lamb from Junction City, which is about a two-hour drive from here. We've got pork from Willamette Valley as well. Lettuces and all the vegetables, of course, come from the farms around the area. I mean, the only thing you kind of have to draw the line somewhere.
Coffee.
What do you do with salt and pepper and spices and, of course,
chocolate.
You've got olive oil and chocolate and coffee. I mean, those are the things that the staples you have to have. That have been existing for centuries, but
yeah, you have chocolatiers there, though. I mean, the beans aren't grown there, but the chocolate's made there.
Oh yes, we have definitely wonderful chocolate makers here for sure.
Now we were looking for a recipe. We got some scallops for tonight, which were 6 to a pound.
Wow. Okay.
So we looked in your index, only to be disappointed. I guess you can't get scallops in Oregon.
Yeah, you know, there's a limited amount of shellfish out here that at this point is allowed to be fished, and I think the number is expanding. For years and years, we've been spoiled. Halibut and salmon and a raised clams and a few other like black cod have been pretty much staples in our diets here in the Northwest. But as the time progresses and the fish supply is dwindling, like the salmon, we're going to be looking to expand our ideas. And I'm really happy to be one of those guys that's like pushing the envelope of trying to, it's like, okay, there's 75 fishes of bottom fitting fish out there. Let's just bring them in and identify them and then serve them. And you know what?
Yeah, we just talked to somebody who just joined the Monterey Fish Watch, whatever.
Yeah.
I think we first had razor clams.
I was going to say, don't tell me they're endangered.
Right? Yeah, we had razor clams at the Heathman Bar and Pub.
Uh huh. Yeah.
The first time I think we were ever in Portland together.
Oh, those are wonderful, and I believe they're in abundance. There's really not.
Oh, they are still okay.
Oh, they're okay.
Oh, yeah. No, there's not even really a perfectly identified season for them. They're usually based on the soil acid levels. That's when they're allowed to dig them, and they pretty much dig throughout the year. There's several digs in the spring.
Yeah, most people just don't even know about them. It's not been on the East Coast. They've not put them on the menu.
And the funny thing was that we had them in England. A couple of times recently, and you know, when I was a child growing up there, you never saw anything like that. I guess they must, if they caught them, they must have just thrown them away.
Oh, they did. Yeah, you see them lying all over the beaches.
And now people have decided. Well, now people recognize this is exactly how delicious they are.
Oh, they're wonderful.
Oh,
they're
yeah, meaty. I love them.
Oh yeah.
We're going to make
crab. Yeah.
The what? We're going to make. I want to say.
Indigenous crab is also.
Oh yeah, no, you have recipes for that.
Going
in there.
Crazy right now with the season, and that's something that we can get pretty much all year long, as well.
Oh, that's very special to your area too, and we're going to make this crisp pan fried lamb's tongue with spicy saffron aioli at some point.
Oh good. That was a bit of an inspiration. I remember one day, again going back to my Russian roots, I remember eating little tongue sandwiches in New York City, and I've always kind of wanted to do something out here, and I thought lamb's tongue would be nice and small and petite to be able to kind of introduce some local folks to, you know, and a little handmade aioli next to it is really, and of course anything fried goes, so.
The mantra in the restaurant is everything's better with bacon or better.
I agree with that, but Ann tries to keep me away from that.
Well, yeah.
Everything in moderation.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay.
Well, this is a wonderful cookbook, and I would recommend this to anybody who likes flavor, freshness, and style. I mean, there's a lot of style to this book.
Well, and the ingredients, of course, you know, they're definitely, most of them are particular to our region, but there are plenty of substitutions that you can do, especially if you're from the East Coast, and also you can we profess really not just cooking from the book, but also really exploring your region and identifying some of the treasures that people have around the country, and really, you know, connecting with the farmers, connecting with the people that grow those products and supply those products, and really talking to them and understanding what it is that they should do with them. And I think we really want to promote everybody understanding and going back to the roots, and that's the main mantra of the book, is really knowing your region.
And so you could essentially, whatever region you are, you could fill in the blanks and say, in place of Lars the Mushroom Man, I have Fred the Mushroom Man.
Exactly.
We have a
lettuce man. Yeah, we do have a mushroom man.
Yeah, there's a recipe in there for vegetables cooked with miso butter, which is just more of a guide than a recipe, really. And it's just like you go to your farmer's market and whatever is freshest and whatever's in season, buy it, take it home, and then just make a little miso butter and then just toss it together, and that's it.
Well, you did a wonderful job on this cookbook, and we can't recommend it highly enough. And I love talking to you too.
And if you could you hang on the line when I stop the recorder, because I have something separate I want to ask you about.
Absolutely.
Okay, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Vitaly and Kimberly, or Kimberly and Vitaly, whichever way it's supposed to be.
Thank you.
And it was a delight to have you on the program and connect the dots, and this is a cookbook people should add to their collection.
Thank you so much. We had a wonderful time talking to you.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Me too. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, that was an interesting chat, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Remember to email us at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Or go to our blog on themenuradio.blogspot.com, or Twitter me at OTMDish on Twitter.com.
Boy, we
or go find me on Facebook.
Yeah, we're just online all over the. We're just
Plaxo,
online all over the
I'm
place.
I'm on there too.
Yeah. Well, what are we going to do next?
Well, a few weeks ago, I was going to put another one in here. Let's do the bread next. I've talked to a number of people, and nobody seems to know this about this new technique for bread. I read about it in the New York Times and Bittman's column a while ago, and then finally we got this book called Needlessly Simple. Well, you'll hear about this. It's amazing.
Well, I've just been talking to our next guest, Nancy Baggett, saying that I don't know where I've been. I've been my head in the sand or whatever. Certainly not at the bread oven, because I'm stunned by her book called Needlessly Simple, Fabulous Fuss-Free, No-Need Breads. I never knew, Nancy, that there was such a thing.
Absolutely. There are no-need breads that have been circulating around big time on the Internet for the past 3 or 4 years. I guess the opening shot was a recipe that was in the New York Times.
Yeah, that was, I remember that
Bittman's
recipe.
Bittman's column. And
Mark
that
Bittman.
Just took off, Mark Bittman's column in the Times. The recipe was actually from a New York City baker named Jim Leahy. And that kind of got things going again, although the technique is quite a bit older than that. I actually wrote years ago in the mid-80s a bread book, and I was trying at that time, as I am now, to make bread baking accessible for all those people who are afraid that they don't have the wherewithal, they don't have the time, they don't know how to knead. And that book actually called for, had a recipe in it that called for a similar method where that all involves low rise on the countertop. Now, the new wrinkle in the recipes in Needlessly Simple are that they all call for using ice cold water, and that is a new technique. The needless spreads actually go back to antiquity when people didn't know that manipulating it by pulling it back and forth was actually something that you should do. We think of it as being the traditional way,
but it's not.
Ancient times, yes. I spoke to a bread chemist not too long ago who said that, he's traveled examining what people do on occasion in various parts of the world, and where the Industrial Revolution still hasn't really come because electricity is either non-existent or too expensive.
said, the village baker will sometimes dump all the flour into a big tub and add his yeast and water in and stir with a big shovel and then go away for 24 hours and come back and the dough will have kneaded itself,
which is exactly the same
technique that I'm using, yes.
I remember reading this recipe, and Peter probably doesn't remember it, but I showed it to him, and I said, do you think this actually would work? And then I was going to test it, and I promptly forgot about it because I'm not really that much of a baker. But now I think I need, since this is exactly the opposite of what I know about baking bread, but what my mother taught me, for example, we were always taught that you had to keep it all warm.
Now, that is correct.
Now, it's all about the chemistry. Could you just explain why this works?
I will explain why it works, and that is a breakthrough, actually, using the ice-cold water, and it is partly dependent, I must admit, on using the rapid-rising yeast. Well, the ironic thing, of course, is the recipes do not rise rapidly. They rise slowly, and that is because you don't use a lot of the yeast. But the reason that you use the rapid-rising yeast is particles are very fine, which means it will come to life, hydrate, as the chemist would say, will hydrate very well, even if you just mix it in with the flour and then you dump in the ice-cold water. And the advantage, and the chemists really don't fully understand yet why the advantage works or why it happens, but the advantage is by making the water very cold and taking the temperature of the dough down instead of up like you would normally expect, is it's called retarded first fermentation. That's very fancy talk for saying that when you stir it together, the yeast kind of goes to sleep for a little while, and the dough gets a chance for other things besides the dough besides the dough fermentation to happen. And the way the chemist explained it to me is there are enzymes in the yeast and enzymes in the flour, and they all start acting and causing great things to happen. And I've done some, I never believe what they tell me without doing my own, analysis. Mm-hmm. And so I took side by side, same ingredients, same method, except using regular warm water and then ice cold water. And what I discovered is you get a better flavor, it's nuttier, it's richer, and it's also a little sweeter, almost as if you had added sugar in, even if the dough doesn't happen to have any. The dough will have a smoother, just nicer texture, and it will also brown better. So you get all these advantages by basically doing no extra work. And the other, of course, a part of it is that slow rise actually causes better flavor to develop, in the same way that slow works with wine.
So you actually have to do less work, right? Because you don't have to do all that muscular kneading.
No, and that you not only don't have to do any kneading, but you actually can keep your countertops from getting mussed up. So you don't have that usual, the whole kitchen looks like you drop, sprinkled flour over it. You can, if you use a nice big bowl, and I do recommend a big bowl, because if you're letting that dough rise over the course of 12 to 18 hours as opposed to what is usually called for, it's going to puff up maybe triple, maybe even quadruple, and people aren't usually expecting that. So you do need a great big bowl. But then you just stir everything together in the bowl, make sure you cover it so that it doesn't dry out, because that is a long-standing period.
And you say you can even put it in the refrigerator.
You can. And, in fact, I actually did some examination of that process. If you go, I only have 5 minutes now to stir it together, and you really don't want to be bothered with it for a while, or you want even more flavor advantages, put it in the refrigerator, or as I can in the winter, put it in my garage where it's cold and let it stay there. And then those advantages that I was mentioning from the retarded first fermentation actually are accentuated even more. That's totally optional, though. I like to give a lot of options in the book, so it really is designed for people who may not have much time to spend it in the kitchen. So you can come in, do 5 minutes, set it away and forget about it for 12 to 18 hours or even longer if you do the refrigeration first. So I try to be as flexible as possible to fit people's lifestyles.
Now, it seems, Nancy, though, that you've just given away the whole secret.
I have.
So why do you need a book?
Well,
I mean, it's
great recipes.
It's a very big, beautiful book.
Oh, the pictures are great, Nancy.
Thank you.
So the recipes have to change as well?
Well, the formulas do change, and I'll give you one of the tips as to why. There isn't a whole lot of yeast used, and so when the yeast that is used, for example, a 3-cup flour recipe of bread might only take 3/4 teaspoon of yeast, as opposed to that whole packet that one yeast to call for. And the yeast is very sensitive to the environment, and so it does slow down when the water is cold and the whole dough becomes cold. And there are other things that will have an enormous influence. For example, I discovered, not that it's great news, but I discovered that a lot of people don't know this, that there are any number of ingredients that can inhibit the yeast.
Yeah, I read that. You said
some of these
things like, fruit, dried fruits?
Dried fruits, and the reason, there's different reasons. If you want to throw dried fruit in, I always suggest, or most always suggest, it depends on the recipe, that you need to run it under hot water first, just to hydrate the fruit a little bit, because one of the things that yeast need to grow, basically, is water. And if the dry fruit is sucking all the water out of the dough, then the yeast isn't going to do very well. But there are other ingredients, actually. Garlic, for example. I have a roasted garlic bread in the book, and I caution people. I tell them you want to roast the garlic in advance in a little olive oil, and then you add in a little Parmesan, and you mash the garlic and the Parmesan, and you get this wonderful aroma and flavor of garlic. Obviously, this is for someone who likes garlic bread.
Me too.
Only, it's much better than your typical salted, garlic salted bread. But in any case, I make a point of saying, even if you like garlic an extra whole lot, don't add extra garlic in here because it is inhibiting. Cinnamon is inhibiting, which is why. For people who never understood why the loaves you always see with cinnamon bread are swirled, it's because if you stir the cinnamon right into the dough instead of swirling it, rolling it up in a pinwheel, it will inhibit the dough to the point that it hardly rises at all.
You know, about your book, I mean, first of all, you have wonderful endorsements here by two of our favorite, we've had them as guests, is Peter Reinhardt and Nick Malgeri.
Yes, thank you.
Of them. Yeah, they rave about this book.
Oh, thank you.
I think that you really want to help people in this book. You have not only your introduction, but all your basics, you talk about the ingredients, you go into every little detail, and then you also have a troubleshooting section.
Yes, I do.
So that, it seems to me that it would be hard to fail.
Well, you know, that is really what I was hoping, because I know that there are so many people, to me there is no more wonderful experience, and if your mother baked, you probably recall that too, and I certainly do from my mother. There's no better experience than being there and watching someone or doing it yourself once I got old enough, and then make the dough, and then make the bread, and put it in the oven, and then that aroma. You just have people circling the oven, or I usually do, looking through the glass, waiting for it. And so, but there are so many people that are intimidated by the process, and so my approach really was, how can I make this as non-threatening and as comfortable and as foolproof as possible. So I'm glad you picked up on that. Appreciate that.
Now, Nancy, to what extent has this crossed over into commercial baking? I mean, is it a revolution?
It is in commercial baking.
Oh, it is.
It's very interesting. The recipe that was in the New York Times that sort of got the latest no-knead craze going was from Jim Leahy, who is a commercial baker of, let me think if I can remember what the name of his, Sullivan Street Bakery is the name of his bakery.
Sure.
And so he is using the technique. I also know that I believe they're called Clear Flour Bakery, and they are in Massachusetts, I think in the Boston area, but I couldn't swear to it. They are using the ice water method. I don't know that they're using the retarded first fermentation the way I know that Jim Leahy is using it, and I'm not sure they are at Clear Flour, but they are definitely using the ice cold water method. And my take is, and in fact, I give credit in the book, you're absolutely right about Peter Reinhardt. I actually learned about the ice cold water method from him in his wonderful book, The Bread Baker's Apprentice.
Oh, yeah.
And he actually discovered that technique and gave credit to a French baker whose name was Philippe Gosselin, and said that everybody was raving about his baguettes and what was the secret to why they were so much more flavorful. Because of course, with a baguette, a classic French baguette and many classic breads, there's really not much in there for the flavoring. You've got salt, you've got which flavors, you've got the yeast and its development, and of course the taste of the flour. Other than that, you've got nothing but water. Mm-hmm. And so the ice-cold water method was a way to cause these enzymes to go to work and create levels of flavor and texture that you wouldn't get before.
Now you have, I'm looking at a picture of easy buttermilk pot bread with coarse salt, which of course looks delicious, but it reminded me that the other innovation is you encourage people to actually bake them in a, you know, just in any ordinary pot.
I do. Now that was another tip in fact, we have, again, sort of lost the tradition of it. And when Jim Leahy's recipe was in the Times, he mentioned you can get a better crustiness from the loaf by, as a home cook. Now, in a commercial oven, they've got steam jets. But he was saying that for the commercial oven, it's a different situation. But for the home cook, the way to get that steam going is to actually take the dough, put it into the hot pot already preheated, top it with the lid, snap the lid down on, and then let it bake, and then the steam, as the bread is beginning to bake, will actually cause the crusting and the browning of the crust. And he was right. The interesting thing is, this technique of baking bread in a Dutch oven, even though we've kind of lost the tradition.
It's ancient, isn't it? Yeah.
It's 19th century.
Right.
I've got a whole collection of 19th century American cookbook and 18th century, and they will say, put the bread in, they called them spiders. And why did they call them spiders? Because it was a big black Dutch oven, and it had four legs on the bottom, and you could set it in the fireplace.
How wonderful.
So the tradition is actually an old one, and campers have never given up the tradition.
This is true. Now, Nancy, one other question here is,
sure.
Do you ever use any other technique now that you've discovered this? Do you go back to using our old warm technique?
I thought that I would, because that's the way my mother did it. And I have some traditional recipes, you know, that were hers, but I do not. And there are a couple reasons why. Number one, like everybody else, I'm busy. I don't like cleaning up the countertop, so I can blow in, and literally in 5 minutes, because I already am stocked with the flour and the yeast and the salt, I can zip things together into a bowl, set it, cover it up, put it out on my porch, and then not worry about it. Well, in the winter, I can put it on the porch and not worry about it, and then come back 12 to 18 hours later and work with it, put it in. Many of the breads don't require any shaping, so again, you don't need to get the counter dirty. You just toss that bread right into the loaf pan and then let it rise again and bake it. So I thought that I would, and the other advantage is that long, slow rise, and the doughs tend to be a little moister. That's part of the reason the dough does knead itself. It facilitates that bubbling action. It actually means that the breads stay fresh longer because they are more fully hydrated. So you get an additional advantage that, particularly with the French bread kind of loaves where there is no additional oil in them, you know, a French bread, whether you get it from a bakery or whether you try to make one at home, they usually will be dried out in a day or two. And these actually will stay moist 2-3 even longer. 4 days.
Amazing.
Well, this is wonderful news for people who would like to be bakers, but they're too lazy, or they don't like the mess.
And they don't have enough time.
And
Nancy, a wonderful book, Needlessly Simple, that will help to make sure that you not only understand the concept, but all the tricks of the trade that you've learned through your experimentation. So thank you so much.
One other thing I'd to mention is her website, which is...
Oh, yes. People can, if they're interested and, you know, intrigued by what we've been talking about, www.kitchenlane, all standard spelling, all lowercase, all one word, kitchenlane.com. and I have a couple recipes posted and also a video so they can actually see how the bread baking looks, and they'll see
wonderful.
That it's dead easy.
Nancy, thank you so much. I'm really impressed.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks,
I may try this.
I wish you would. I think you'll be pleased. I'm very excited with it myself, and I use the method myself exclusively now.
Oh, dear. Well, Nancy, let us know what's next.
Okay, I sure will.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you,
Nancy.
Happy
Bye.
Baking.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So now let's take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and now we're actually where we are when I started to introduce this next guest. I said a few weeks ago, meaning I was going to continue and say, a few weeks ago we interviewed Nancy Harmon Jenkins about the new Mediterranean diet, and now here we have her daughter, Sarah Jenkins, also a devotee of Mediterranean flavors. I guess she grew up, and they lived all around the Mediterranean. This, if you want vibrant recipes, this is a fabulous book. It's called Olives and Oranges, and let's hear what Sarah has to say.
Sarah Jenkins, you have such a beautiful book here in Olives and Oranges. You have very, very personal reasons for writing this book. What is it that you were explaining to me about how you cook and how you want to do things and the kind of food you really like?
Well, I grew up in the Mediterranean. I love Mediterranean food. I often say that I learned how to cook because I moved to America in 1981 to go to boarding school, and there wasn't a lot of good food around.
And this, we're talking Italy, Spain, Cyprus,
Maine,
and beyond.
Maine, right. Oh, Maine, I went to boarding school.
Oh, no, I meant that we're talking about
food there is probably almost as good as it is in English boarding school.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes, I grew up in Beirut, spent time in Cyprus, we spent time in Spain, we spent time in France, and primarily in Italy, where my parents bought a house and we really put down some roots.
And our listeners, regular listeners to On the Menu, will know that they interviewed your mother for On the Menu about, I think the latest book was the New Mediterranean Diet.
Yeah, New Mediterranean Diet.
Right.
New Mediterranean cuisine, yeah.
Yeah, and she's a food writer, but you're also a chef.
I'm a chef.
And a restaurateur.
And a, yes.
Your restaurant is Porchetta in Manhattan. Okay, so we're back to now your reasons. You were explaining about how you found you were doing cooking.
Well, I've always maintained that and my success as a chef has been that I'm a home cook in a professional situation, and the food I cook is, it's not haute gastronomy, it's simple food, the kind of food that I grew up eating in a restaurant. You know, when I was a kid, you saw the owners of the restaurants that we ate in, you saw them in the market in the morning, and they were looking at what was best and purchasing. You know, if eggplant were really wonderful in season, then you would go into the restaurant that night and eggplant would be on the menu. If sardines looked magnificent, then it would be sardines. And that's the way I grew up shopping and eating, and the way I continue to, and the way I've designed my menus in the professional kitchens that I've worked in. So the book is a reflection of that, I suppose. And trying to encourage people to trust their instinct a little and get back in the kitchen and not be afraid of food. Food is simple. You know, making a good meal is actually a pretty simple thing.
You said something very interesting before we came on the air, because as a professional chef, you learn lots and lots of techniques that I guess the home chef, home cook doesn't know about. So you said, when I took the recipes home and I tested them home, complete that thought for us, because it was very interesting.
There were some things that you start doing in a restaurant because it's very different. You're trying to prepare a lot of food for all these different ingredients and have them available to cook quickly. And at home, in a way, it's a lot easier because you're just sort of going from A to B and then putting a meal on the table for four people, six people maybe. And one of the biggest examples of that was roasted vegetables. And I have all sorts of restaurant recipes with roasted vegetables, and inevitably we blanch the vegetables and then...
Individually. Yeah.
And then when somebody orders them, you brown them in the pan, and it makes everything work, and you get a much nicer product than if you roasted the vegetables 6 hours earlier and held them and waited until somebody ordered them. But when I was home testing the recipes and, you know, blanching the third vegetable on my four-burner stove, this is ridiculous, and nobody wants to do it. And I realized that actually at home where, you know, okay, it's going to take me half an hour to get these vegetables roasted, so toss them all together with olive oil and salt and pepper and throw them in the pan half an hour before I want them in the oven, and there you go.
Yeah, we,
but, of course,
we
that wouldn't
that
work
with,
in a restaurant.
Yeah, we did that for Greek vegetables for parties for years and years and years. I also had the experience with, we had a vegetarian friend, and I got very ambitious so that it wouldn't be just sort of your usual boring vegetarian fare, and I did one of those, each single vegetable had to have been boiled separately or steamed, whatever had to be done with it. It took forever, absolutely forever.
Yeah, you're you know, either you've got to clean every pot in between or use eight pots, or it just doesn't work.
Do you have another example, Sarah?
Well, there were some pasta dishes that it was kind of interesting. There was the pasta dish that I was very famous for at 50 Carmine that was pasta and red wine sauce, where you actually cooked the raw pasta in wine, almost like a risotto, so that it absorbed up all the wine.
Uh-huh.
And, again, this was sort of easy in a restaurant because you're not ever really doing more than one or two pastas at a time. But when I started trying to put together pasta for six people in a pot with red wine sauce, it was, again, really complicated and really difficult and ultimately didn't make it into the book.
So in that case, size was the other way around. You found it difficult to make as much as you wanted.
Right. And another example is a lot of times in restaurants we sear fish fillets, right? And again, you're doing one or two fish fillets. I mean, obviously you're serving a lot of people, but at any one time you might have three in a pan at most.
Right.
Now, at home, all of a sudden you're trying to sear, you know, six different fish fillets in six different small pans on four burners. It doesn't work. And what I'd forgotten and what I love is to take a whole piece of fish with the skin on and put it skin side up on the broiler with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper and cook it for that old adage, 10 minutes an inch. And it's fabulous every time.
10 minutes an inch. Tell us about that. I don't think I know that one.
Yeah, that would be about right, too.
Yeah, it is. Is that in Roman's new ratio book? He should have that in his book.
Probably. Right. I mean, that's about how long I finish up cooking it. I started off with the skin side on, and the way a broiler works, if you left it under the broiler for 10 minutes, the skin would all be burnt.
So I take
it out of the broiler, take the fish off, and then return that to the oven so that it bakes on its own,
right,
but doesn't get burnt.
Right, right. Well, I like the skin to get not blackened burnt, but quite brown and crispy.
Yeah, well, that's what we do, too.
That's what we do, but I found that outdoors it was different, and it was easier to take the skin off anyway. And it's just one of those tricks that you have, and then a bulky broiler. Let's just leave it at that.
Now, here's a recipe for pasta with roasted cauliflower, olives, capers, and breadcrumbs. And it reminds me a little bit that I grew up in a Sicilian household. Pasta with sautéed cauliflower, onions. So we did not have the olives and capers. We had the breadcrumbs, and then we had fennel fronds. That reminds me of that, but it was called Pasta Indiana, and I never understood where it came from.
Right. No, I don't know, because it sounds like there's that pasta con le sarde that has the fennel greens and the sardines in it.
Yeah, well, we didn't have sardines.
Right.
Now, you have a two-year-old, right?
I'm sorry, one more
you
time?
You have a two-year-old child?
I have a two-year-old child.
And what does she eat, or he?
He. You know, he's pretty amazing. He eats just about everything. And I just expose him to food. He eats cheese.
Now, you didn't get this. My daughter-in-law, with his first child, I had never seen anything like it, had like a 3-inch thick manual of what this child was allowed to eat from the pediatrician. This is,
you know, there's a lot of stuff about that, and I followed some of it attentively. You know, they're not supposed to eat this for the first year, and they're not supposed to eat that. But
no fish for over a year.
Yeah, why was that?
I don't know.
Yeah,
just crazy.
I fed him fish. I didn't feed him shellfish.
Right.
Because that's an old allergy thing, which I don't really...
Yeah. Our son, curious enough, had that, but then grew out
briefly,
of it.
Briefly, very
then,
briefly.
Then he grew out of it.
Right.
Because he used to eat scallops all the time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But no, and the nuts and the
the wheat and the, I mean, just it's craziness.
And it's weird because, you know, again, every culture has their own food sort of prohibitions. So you have to balance it a little bit. They said not to eat spicy food and not to eat garlic when you were breastfeeding.
Uh-huh.
Because it would flavor the milk, and then they wouldn't like it. And I thought that's the way you start a child eating pasta with butter, and that's it. And I ate everything.
I think
so
you
that
should.
Might be part of it.
Well, you know, it's. I just think that we're expanding in allergies and allergic reactions. And I think that if you suddenly introduce something into a child's system after not having anything like it gradually, that you're encouraging that kind of allergy.
Could be.
In the olives and oranges part of the world, they don't do that, do they?
No, they don't. They don't. And I remember, again, when I was pregnant, you know, sushi is one of those things that you're not allowed to eat. And yet Japanese women eat sushi throughout their entire pregnancy. So.
I know. But they, of course, they probably don't eat as many freshwater fishes as we do. They probably have more seafood. Now, I wanted to ask you something else that I clear. Oh, yeah. Your restaurant, Porchetta, you're right on trend here. Why are people so totally crazy about pork right now? I mean, Porchetta, of course, is pulled. I mean,
It's pulled pork,
right?
It's not pulled pork. It's a whole roasted loin with the belly wrapped around it.
Oh, I see. So it's like the whole thing, right?
Yeah, it's a whole. I mean, it's a complete pig.
Yeah, but my question is really: you find any menu, you find all these restaurants like the Spotted Pig, like Porchetta, all devoted to pork and the pig. Why is it? And Fergus Henderson's thing. Why is everybody suddenly crazy about pork?
Well, I think in the past 10 years, we've suddenly gone from, you know, they kept trying to make pork more lean and industrially raised pork, and it lost its flavor and it lost its fat. And in the past 10 years, there's been a real movement starting with Nyman to raise pork humanely, and we've sort of rediscovered the flavor that pork has.
I think the other thing is it's a whole lot less expensive. I mean, remember, we're in times when people are looking for the less expensive. And they discover they love it. So it's economical, but they also discover they like it.
We just ordered this heirloom red wattle pork from Heritage Meats or whatever it's called.
Somewhere in Missouri.
And I mean, it's just amazing to taste the difference. Just even in the sausage meat.
Yeah, I don't even want to go back to Neiman Ranch pork chops now.
They're changing too, I hear. What do you hear, Sarah?
How do you mean they're changing?
When they were sold, and the founder it came out in great opposition to the fact that they're changing all the beliefs that Neiman was founded on.
Right. I don't know. It's hard. I find that in the meat business, everybody disparages everybody else.
Okay.
And I find that at the farmer's market, that the only farmer there who's ever raising meat properly is the one that you're actually talking to.
Okay.
And I find that with my meat purveyors, and I find that, and I suppose at the end of the day, really, how far do you want to take the responsibility? I always feel like I really need to go and look at these farms myself, but I haven't made it that far yet.
Yeah. It
seems to me that this is a fabulous cookbook. This is probably one I'm going to use more than any other one, just because of the things you told me about adapting it to the home cook, because I'm an extraordinarily limited home cook.
Mm-hmm.
but I guess every now and then I do okay.
Right.
You do fine.
Well, this week, what did we have this week? We had kidneys this week. We had veal kidneys this week.
Yeah. Do you know that veal kidneys are, talk about things out of favor or style. I checked Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything for a veal kidney recipe, and it's not even in there.
Goodness. Yeah, I don't think
we checked how many cookbooks before
cookbook,
we got.
The Gourmet Cookbook doesn't have one. The Bon Appetit Cookbook doesn't have one.
But the old Gourmet Cookbook has it. The two-volume one, which is
there probably isn't a veal kidney recipe in this one either. That's all right.
No, I don't have a
French
veal kidney recipe.
It's a French thing.
Yeah, we didn't look up this book anyway. But give us a couple of real highlights to finish off. What two of your absolute favorite recipes?
Well, one of my favorite recipes, which always sends everybody for a head spin, is strawberry risotto. And
right.
It was something that a restaurant that I loved and that my family loved began doing in Rome. in the spring. And it's one of those things, it was very sort of nouvelle cuisine-esque, I suppose, and all of a sudden everybody in Rome made it, and now I don't think anybody in Rome makes it anymore.
But you can make it for yourself because the recipe's in this book.
Exactly, and it's not sweet, it's a wonderful, savory, beautiful dish, and it's a great thing to make now in the spring.
Okay, one more.
One more. The olive oil cake, actually, which is another cake that sort of makes everybody feel very unusual, olive oil in a cake. But it makes a wonderful, lush, rich cake, and it's so easy.
Do you do preserved lemons in here? I didn't look for that.
I didn't do a recipe for preserved lemons because I think I only used them once in that book.
Every time I make them, they sit in there, and I'm never... The refrigerator, I'm never sure how long I can keep them.
They sit there until we're sure they've expired, and then we throw them out.
Right. Well, you know, I'll tell you, my husband is Moroccan, and the last time I went to Morocco, I decided that those lemons are much, much older than anybody ever tells us to let them be.
You think
and the
so?
Flavor is really wonderful and pronounced.
So we should never, next time we did make them, we should just say no expiration date.
Exactly.
Have you tried playing around with fermented black garlic yet?
No, I have not.
She's from the Mediterranean, love. This
I know,
is
this
Korea.
This is Korean, but I mean, all the chefs that I'm talking to are going crazy trying to find out how to use this.
Huh? Interesting. And it's something that you buy already fermented and
somebody's they're either importing it fermented or they know the process and they're doing it along the way, so it comes already.
It's www.blackgarlic.com.
There you go. But then she'll have to write a whole new book. Because
<Yes.
laughs> there's no recipes in this book.
But it reminds me of the English chef who had me put this lime to the point on the counter, to the point where it turned absolutely black.
Yes,
that concept, you know, fermenting it. Except I never got to taste it because the housekeeper threw it out.
Oh no!
Yeah, that was David Everett Mathias at the Champignon Sauvage.
Yeah.
I mean, he was so delighted with it. He said it changed the flavor altogether. So he gave us one. So we carried it around for 2 weeks, and then brought it home. And then, as I said, Anne said it got thrown out. Anyway, this wonderful book is
Sarah,
called
Congratulations. And I want to just conclude with, I think this is a wonderful thing that Mario Batali said about you. You're a gifted and natural cook with olive oil in your veins and blood oranges in your heart.
Yeah.
I love that.
I'm rather flattered.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, thank you again, Sarah.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, keep us posted on what you're doing.
I certainly will.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, watch out. This is a tricky transition here. I'm going to pick up on a product, a word. It's called olives, extended to olives, olive oil. And now you're going to meet Fran Gage, who has written a very, very valuable book steering you to the new American olive oil. So let's listen to Fran. Fran Gage has such a long list of credentials, ranging from her very popular pastry shop in San Francisco to her cookbooks and her magazine articles. And on and on and on. Am I right, Fran?
Yes, thanks.
You have a lot of hats. But anyhow, what we're going to be talking to you about here is something that's very dear to my heart, is the New American Olive Oil, which is your book. I was wondering why nobody had written this book, and then all of a sudden, here it is.
Oh, good.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Tell us a little bit about your background with olive oil.
Well, when I grew up, I really never, as far as I can remember, really never saw olive oil in my home kitchen.
You said that, yeah.
Yeah, and even when I owned the bakery, we made French pastries, and so, of course, we used
butter.
Pounds and pounds of butter. When I owned a bakery, we used pounds and pounds of butter because we were making French pastry. And it wasn't until I was researching for my first book, which is more than 10 years ago now, which is called Bread and Chocolate, when I investigating California olive oil, because I was writing an essay about the California olive oil people, and I came across a notice about a sensory evaluation course given by UC Extension Service about olive oil. And so I went and I took that course for 3 days, and I tasted more olive oil than I had tasted for months.
Uh-huh.
It was very, very interesting. And I sort of put that in the back of my mind and was using more olive oil in my kitchen, but not certainly not exclusively. then 5 years passed, and I got a letter saying that the California Olive Oil Council was looking for new members for their taste panel, and would I be interested in coming and taking a test to see if I could join that panel? And I thought, well, I have nothing to lose here. So I went, I took this test, which is a test that sort of determines if people can detect very small differences in odors.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I did well enough that I was asked to, asked to join the council.
Now, that's impressive. I mean, I think that council is impressive. We've interviewed, I can't remember, it was the president of the council or spokesperson at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he was so knowledgeable. I was just, I could have listened to him talk for days.
Uh-huh.
He just knew so much about olive oil. Yeah.
And so then I started tasting olive oil with the council, and then I also taste oil with the UC Research Group,
uh-huh.
And I've been a judge at the Los Angeles International Olive Oil Competition and at the Yolo County Fair. So I'm definitely into olive oil now.
Yeah. Now tell us about the book. I mean, you give background on the olive oil industry, which developed primarily in California.
Yes.
And, you know, you had a thing in there that it had just escaped me altogether. You talked about how it didn't develop for a long time because the olives were in demand for canned olives.
Yes.
And I had forgotten that we used to have at home all these cans of black olives, and they have a very distinctive taste. They're terrible.
It's terrible. You're right. You're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd forgotten about that it was such a big industry. Have they all gone away?
No, they're still produced. In fact, there are quite a few of them on the market still. But the tides sort of turned, and people realized that it might be better to make oil out of these olives rather than canning them. And so, in addition to the olives that they had been using for canning, a lot of people started planting different kinds of trees, Tuscan style trees, Tuscan varietals rather, and some others. So that in addition to the older trees that had been used for canning, then there were some new trees as well.
Now, you go back to the days of the Spanish missions in California to when the first olive trees were planted.
Right? Yeah.
I was just reading that the olive groves, I guess, were not maintained as well once the missions went away.
That's right, yeah.
But there's been clearly a number of changes of heart since then. But there was a sort of singular event you referred to, the 1997 tasting, which is a little bit like the Judgment of Paris for California wines in 1976.
Yes, that's true. In 1997, there was a blind olive oil tasting in Italy, and Ridgely Evers entered his Davvero olive oil, and it won.
Yes,
like
that's amazing.
The California wine won in the Paris competition.
And how would you compare California olive oils to, like, Italian, say Tuscan?
Well, it's a Tuscan. If you're in Tuscany, you grow a particular variety of olives. It's just not one. It's a group of varietal olives. And some people are doing that here in California. But people in California are also growing, you know, Spanish-style olives, and a couple people have some French varietals. And rather than just press oil from a certain group of varietals, sometimes they mix them up, so you get different flavor profiles. Although certainly some of the Tuscan-style oil being made in California can stand up to the Tuscan-style oil made in Tuscany.
You know, you have... There are a number of features in this book that make it desirable as a reference book. You have recipes,
mm-hmm.
very interesting recipes. I might add, like escarole soup with bacon, for example, and some of the breads are amazing here. And then you also list producers.
Yes.
How did you select the producers?
Well, that's an interesting question. I wanted to have profiles of some producers so people reading the book would get a flavor about the people who are actually making this olive oil in California, because they're very diverse. And I could have profiled 200 people, but that wasn't the scope of the book. So I tried to find people who, first of all, made good olive oil. I mean, that was the absolute first requirement. And then people who were in different parts of the state, because there are people in all over California who are making olive oil. And then I tried to think about very small producers. I profile a woman who only sells her olive oil in farmers markets. She's somebody who won a best of show in the Los Angeles competition a couple of years ago. And then I talk about very, very large producers like the California Olive Ranch or Corto, who are planting acres and acres of olive trees. So that is, the style is completely different. And then I talked about, I wanted people, too, who had interesting stories. So I profiled the UC Davis olive oil program. At the university at Davis has lots of olive trees on the campus that were there before the school was. And people just kind of ignore these trees, except that they really caused lots of problems because when the olives ripened and then dropped, several were near a very well-trafficked bicycle path.
Uh-huh.
And people were falling on the.
Yeah,
you know.
So you got a real mess. It's sort of like walking down the street after all the ginkgo nuts have fallen off.
Yes, I mean it was terrible. And the director of Buildings and Grounds saw yet one other kid hit the pavement from his bicycle one day, and sort of had an aha moment and thought maybe we should harvest these olives and do something with them rather than, you know, go through this every year. And so that's exactly what they did.
Now, you have a very interesting guy. I can't remember his name, but his olive oil producer is called Apollo.
Yes.
And he's doing something rather special, you said.
Yes, yes. That's another group of another group up in the Sierra foothills. So their elevation is a little higher than lots of other people. And they have quite a variety of olives. They have all sorts of olives up there. And what they wanted to do was they didn't like their old stone press, so they wanted a new kind of system to produce the olive oil. And through Daryl Corti, who's he calls himself a grocer, but the man is very knowledgeable in many fields. Through him, they got to a man in Italy who has this idea about a new sort of a closed, almost closed system of milling oil that decreases the oxidation of the oil as you're producing it. So you get very high polyphenol levels. And they got one of these systems and put it in, and their olive oil wins awards on a regular basis.
Now, is anybody doing the olive oil style producer we heard about and who's we sampled from Spain?
Oh, that was
good. They pick their olives very, very late, and they don't grind them. They make it a very gentle crush. They take all the olives, they put a few heavy stones on top, and then they just wait for the oil to drip out so it self flows.
Wow!
From the olives, and it's called lacrima, of course, tears. And this is how they make all their olive oil.
Wow,
that's very good.
So if you have influence with the California Olive Oil Council, you might want to suggest to them that'd be something new to experiment with.
Huh.
California would certainly get very ripe olives if you wanted them to be, wouldn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, some people do harvest the olives on the late side. And some people, you know, harvest some olives early and some late, and then like when you're making wine, and then blend the two oils together.
Right. Well, this is a book of great authority, Fran.
Congratulations on a wonderful book.
I won't say that I couldn't put it down, but boy, when I was in the mood to read about olive oil, this was a compelling story, and another fascinating reason why. Perhaps natural agriculture is a good thing, and California, of course, leads the country in that. And you're a part of that movement, so keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, if you write another book, let us know.
I will.
Fran, thank you so much. The book, again, is called
The New American Olive Oil
by Fran Gage, G-A-G-E.
Yes.
And, of course, you can buy it through On the Menu Bookshelf or wherever you shop.
All right, well.
Fran Gage, have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, we were having so much fun, sweetheart. We weren't watching the clock today, but we ran a little over time.
But that's all right.
That's a bonus for all you listeners. We hope you'll get another bonus next week, and you'll come back and join us. Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.